Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in British Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jess Clark, and I'm one of the channel co-hosts. Today, I'm delighted to speak with Dr. Samita Mukherjee, a senior lecturer in history at the University of Bristol, about her new book, Indian Suffragettes, Female Identities and Transnational Networks, published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. In her new book, Mukherjee highlights the centrality of Indian women in the fight for the vote in the first half of the 20th century. Taking up a geographic organization around global contact zones, the author skillfully guides readers through multiple sites of Indian suffragette networking, from Britain and its Commonwealth, to international locales in the US and Europe, to eastern locations like Burma, before concluding in India. This mapping of transnational connections foregrounds the truly global dimensions of the suffrage movement and the ways that Indian women's locality inform their calls for political equality. Mukherjee broadens our understandings of global histories of suffrage, expanding our focus beyond national borders, all while putting Indian women front and center in the struggle for the vote. Samita, welcome.
Hi, Jess. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us. So can we begin by you telling us a bit about yourself and how you came to this project?
Yeah, sure. So just a bit of background, I was born in London. I did my PhD, my DPhil at the University of Oxford. My PhD was on Indians who studied in British universities in the early 20th century. And I've always really been interested in issues of identity and especially how travel affects your identity and your understanding of your place in the world. I think influenced a lot by my own experiences growing up, as someone of Indian ethnicity in Britain and being very conscious of when I went on holiday, when I went to other places, that my ethnicity and my nationality as British was often brought into question. So they're the kind of underpinning things that have really interested me and underpin a lot of my research. I'm also really interested in women's rights and women's history. And so after the PhD, after a postdoc project and various other teaching posts, I really wanted to write this book, which obviously I'll talk a bit more about what the book does in a sec.
Yeah. And I think a lot of those, personal influences are definitely reflected in many of the themes of the book. So turning to the book itself, there's lots to talk about, but you do some really wonderful things with geography and locality. And I think you use it in really productive ways to organize the text. So I want to talk about that more specifically a little bit later. But to begin, I thought we'd talk about some of the sites of Indian suffragettes activism. So the book opens with considerations of their work in Britain and the British Empire in the early 20th century. So can you tell us a little bit more about this particular phase and its significance?
Yeah, sure. I guess I should say that the research for this book really started with a chapter that I wrote that was published in 2011 in an edited collection that I co-edited with my colleague, Ruhana Ahmed. And in that chapter, I wrote about a British woman called Sophia Duleep Singh, who is of Indian ethnicity and who was involved in the British suffrage movement in the 1910s. And then her connections with two Indian women, Herabai Tata and Mitan Tata, who were involved in the Indian suffrage movement. And a lot of my early work was really about Indians in Britain and how Indians in Britain grappled with ideas of being imperial subjects, how they understood the empire, and how they became politicized through coming to Britain. So that's really what that was kind of the starting point for a lot of this, which is why that first chapter starts with Britain and the British Empire. I guess the key thing, so this whole book is about Indian women who were campaigning for the vote from the 1910s onwards until 1950, when universal adult suffrage is introduced in India. And before 1947, India is part of the British Empire. And so much of what is kind of politically enacted in India has to take place in Britain. And a lot of political petitioners from India come to Britain in the 19th and 20th century to discuss political issues with either British politicians or the British public. So a lot of work about Indian mobile subjects in the 19th and 20th century has concentrated on male subjects who've been involved in broader political discussions around nationalism and anti-colonialism and democracy and so forth. And really what I'm trying to do in this book is to show on a very basic level that Indian women were also involved in political discussions around empire, around citizenship and subjecthood, about what it means to be a British subject, what it means to eventually become an Indian national, and how this is all tied into their own involvement in and discussions around the franchise and specifically the women's vote. So in that first chapter, I look at both how Sophia Duleep Singh and other Indians who were living in Britain in the 1910s were initially involved in the British suffrage movement up until 1918, when some women in Britain are given the right to vote. But then also how in the 1910s in particular, there are Indian women coming to Britain and really putting the agenda of the Indian women's franchise on the map of both British politics and British imperial politics and Indian politics more generally.
I think also one of the things that really comes to the fore in the text are the ways that you, you know, in terms of empire, it's not just a focus on activities in the metropole, of course. And by the second chapter, you've moved out to Commonwealth networks, talking about what you term colonial feminism, and especially, and I think really significantly, talking about it in terms of Australia and New Zealand. And I think that, as you note, this is something that hasn't necessarily been touched on too much. So shifting gears a little bit to the broadening out of the book, can you talk a little bit about how these networks came about and what this did in terms of Indian suffragette activity?
Yeah, sure. And again, just to kind of give a bit of background of why I do this. As I said, a lot of my early work was basically just about Indians in Britain and Indians who'd come to Britain and returned to India and the effects of that migration or that travel on Indian politics. And I guess I became increasingly aware through reading and reading other people's work and understanding of the field more broadly, that we can't really think about imperial relations if we just focus on one colony and the metropole, and that Indians weren't just thinking about empire as just their relationship with Britain, but were conscious of the other colonies of the Dominions, and I guess the hierarchies of race and position within the empire, and also the commonalities that they had with other subjects within the British Empire. So what's really fascinating is that Indian women were also really aware of the rest of the empire and were able to utilize, as you said, I described as the kind of colonial feminist links, especially with the white dominions in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, to put forward the campaigns around the vote and really to learn from other women who were both subject citizens, I guess, of the empire. What's really interesting as well when we think about suffrage and suffrage histories is that Australia and New Zealand had enfranchised women before Britain, which is so fascinating if you think about the empire and all the other kind of political relationships. So they were really the kind of the role models that people who were working in and around suffrage really looked to, and especially in New Zealand, which is enfranchised women in 1893, but also at that time enfranchised all women, including Maori women, unlike Australia, which has racial exclusions in when they enfranchised women in 1902. So in terms of the networks and how Indian women are able to engage with those networks, there are kind of, there are two ways in which they do this. They are able, some Indian women are traveling to other parts of the empire or corresponding to these other parts of the empire, and to the women who are working around women's work and rights. There they are, especially, and what I'm really interested in is how they think about the Indian diaspora in these areas as well. So there are a few hundred Indians who live in Australia and Canada at this time. There are more Indians who live in South Africa and Kenya. And really when these Indian women are thinking about the vote and the franchise, they're not just thinking about the franchise for Indians in India, but also the franchise for the Indian diaspora in these other parts of the empire. And also those Australian and New Zealand feminists who had been involved and won the franchise early on in the late 19th and early 20th century were very intimately involved with British networks of suffrage. So a lot of the networks that Indian women had with women from the white dominions in the early 20th century came through meeting in London as a place where people from around the empire came together to discuss political issues and especially the suffrage.
And then eventually you move into a focus on the development of what you term Asian, Oriental, and Eastern networks, with a kind of more dedicated geographic focus on that area. So can you talk a little bit about the development of suffragette networks there and perhaps how that was similar to but also differed from those happening in an imperial context?
Yeah. So before I look at the Asian networks, I actually look at the international networks. So should I discuss?
Oh, yes, please. Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. So I have a bit of a trajectory in the book. I look at, first of all, this traditional idea of empire and a kind of horizontal relationship between Britain and India and how Indian women are using imperial networks because they have to further their campaigns. They are often, I guess, subservient to the British women who are involved in women's rights and suffrage campaigns. So that's kind of the first chapter and how these Indian women are projecting themselves as imperial subjects and citizens and using their imperial subjecthood to start those early campaigns for the votes in India. And then in the next chapter, as I just discussed, they are using wider imperial networks. They are learning from Australia and New Zealand, and they're thinking about the Indian diaspora in other parts of the empire. And then in my third chapter, I look at how they are thinking much more internationally, and especially focusing, when I say internationally, in this context, they are engaging with European, continental Europe, European and American networks of women and women's organizations. And there are some key international women's organizations that engage with, including the International Women's Suffrage Alliance, which was dominated by European and American women. They also engage with the National Women's Party in America. And in that chapter, what I'm really trying to show is that having, as they increasingly try to separate themselves or distance themselves from the overbearing attitude of the British imperial feminists that they had first engaged with, and as they perhaps see some of the limitations of just using their colonial feminist networks, that they are increasingly aware that suffrage is a global, international issue. And as these Indian women are also increasingly engaged with thinking about, as they have to do when they're thinking about suffrage and the franchise and what it means to be someone who has a democratic right as a citizen in their country, they're thinking about then India as a nation and India's place in the world internationally, separate to just empire. So we see in this, in that chapter, how they are, they're just thinking internationally. They are engaging with women around the world, hoping and trying to engage on a more egalitarian basis with women around the world, and yet still facing certain issues of, I wouldn't say discrimination is the right word, but objectification and feelings of exoticization, if I can use that word, which is something that they'd been facing beforehand with their interactions with women in Britain and around the empire.
And so you raise the issue of, as you say, objectification and exoticization, a discussion which extends into the following chapter when you do focus on Eastern networks and the ways in which these operated, but were also, you know, rejected and worked against in this context. So can you speak a little bit about these Eastern networks and what they looked like?
Yeah. So what we see is that in the interwar period, international networks and organizations had become really prominent, especially with the foundation of the League of Nations. But we also see a turn to regional politics and regional organizations and associations, which women are also getting involved in. So we see from the late 1920s onwards that Indian women are turning to very broadly Eastern or Asian networks. And at that time, they were very broad. They extended from the Middle East across to and included Egypt and Turkey, and extended to what we'd now classify as the Asian continent. So what's interesting here is that perhaps this is it's kind of a turn away from those international or imperial networks because they felt that they were being objectified or exoticized and not necessarily being heard. From 1921, some Indian women were getting the vote, and by 1935, most states in India had enfranchised women. But in reality, this meant that very few women had the vote because they were only enfranchised if they had property qualifications. So there was this weird mix of these Indian women being very proud of the fact that they had won the vote, or some Indian women had won the vote by 1921, but also aware that they still had a really long way to go to enfranchise the whole population, and they really wanted to enfranchise all women. And I guess they felt they weren't being heard or being recognised in some of those international networks. So they turn to these Asian networks or these Eastern networks. But what I argue is that it wasn't such a straightforward process here. And we see two things emerging, or not so emerging, but becoming more prominent. One is that Indian women are quite happy to self-orientalize themselves. And actually, despite chafing at the exoticization that other women had imposed upon them, they themselves were often quite happy to utilize stereotypes about the Indian women for their own gain. So stereotypes of Indian women as being family orientated, of being spiritual and domestic. These were all things that they really played up on. And you kind of see they play up on these, even in these more regional Asian or Eastern networks, where they would say us Eastern women have a common affinity around being these domestic, family orientated Asian women, rather than perhaps, as one might kind of hope of them, to emphasize the kind of modern feminist credentials around suffrage that they were engaging it with. And we also see, and this is something I also discuss in my second chapter around the Commonwealth and colonial networks, is that Indian women themselves were often guilty of imposing hierarchies and fashion themselves on as above other women. So we see this in the colonial networks, where they are happy to assert superiority over Aborigine women in Australia or Black Africans in Kenya. So in Kenya, for example, they're very happy that Indian women, or they don't really object when Indian women get the vote in 1924, but Black African women don't get the vote. And then in chapter four, when I discuss these Asian networks, there again, you kind of see the ways in which Indian women are quite keen to assert their superiority over some of their neighbours. They assert their superiority over, to some extent, over their Burmese and Sri Lankan neighbours. They dominate a lot of these Asian or Eastern organizations around suffrage and women's rights. I guess just overall, what I try to do in this book is I'm trying to give agency to these Indian women. I'm trying to show the ways in which Indian women were mobile and engaging with really complex discussions around feminism and suffrage and citizenship. But I'm also gone out to write a hagiographical laudatory account of these women either. And I'm really keen to also show that they themselves were often complicit in using and encouraging racial or imperial hierarchies in their work.
Yeah, and I think that's something that certainly comes across, the kind of the way that structures of power work in these dynamic networks. That certainly comes across. So in terms of the book organization, the chapters move outwards in a lot of ways to encompass, you know, different transnational networks and international networks. And then in a really interesting and I think a really effective move, the final chapter turns to India itself to think about the way that feminist struggles intersected with nationalist and anti-imperialist struggles as well. So can you talk about this final turn to India itself and what this looks like?
Yeah. So I guess what I see and as I chart is that having really try to engage with other women around the world and learning from other women around and teaching other women around the world about what they were doing around suffrage. Ultimately, and you know, it goes back to that very first chapter around empire. Ultimately, India and Indian women are subject to the British Empire and British Crown. And it's, I guess, what's so weird about all their suffrage campaigns is that they are campaigning to have a vote in a legislative assembly where, so they're trying to campaign for democratic rights, even though they are part of an empire and they are subject to the empire. So lots of people, like, so generally people who aren't aware of this history when I've kind of talked about this work, have been surprised that Indian women were even campaigning for the vote before 1947, because they felt, how can you campaign for the vote when you're subject to the empire? And so, yes, but they are. So what's ultimately what these Indian women realise is that although they can get limited democratic rights under the empire, and as I said, by 1935, some women are enfranchised, the only real way in which they can get full adult franchise and also to have a vote and a political voice that can enact change is if India becomes free of the empire and if India gains independence. So I kind of had to at the end turn to look at India itself and how these suffrage debates are so interlinked with nationalist debates too. So although in the book as a whole and the research that I did is much more interested in what women were doing outside of India and about these transnational networks and how they think about their locality and their identities outside of India. I turn to India at the end and think about how the kind of the last few decades of the suffrage movement in India do become very internal and internalized. But that's not to say that it's just about India. So in that last chapter, which is it covers the 1930s and 40s, Indian women are still and almost have to revert back to Britain again as their place of focus for a lot of their campaigns and their debates and their petitioning and organisation and everything else. So it's almost also a kind of bookend to that first chapter where they are returning to Britain, they're involved in the round table conferences and other parliamentary conferences which are being held in London to discuss the constitutional future of India. And whereas in the 1910s, when they'd come to Britain, they had really wanted the help of British feminists and really worked alongside, or not necessarily alongside, but worked under British women. In the 1930s and the 40s, although they are coming to Britain and they still have really strong networks with British women's groups, and British allies, they are trying to assert themselves much more, both in Britain and in India, as independent women who want to really take control and helm of their campaign and of their debates. So, for example, in this chapter, we see how there are British women who are encouraging Indian women to think about suffrage in stages. And that, so having enfranchised women who have some property rights, they are arguing that Indian women the franchise should be increased slowly so that just the wives or widows of Indian men who have the vote could be enfranchised next, or just women who pass certain literacy qualification should have the vote. And other suggestions are given about a kind of a stage-by-stage, slowly process, whereas the majority of Indian women, not all of them, but the majority of Indian women who are involved in the suffrage campaigns by this stage, by the late 30s, or early 30s even, are really pushing for a full adult franchise for all women, and a kind of an immediate full adults franchise. And so we see the ways in which Indian women are fashioning the campaigns very much to ally themselves, I guess, with what's going on in the nationalist realm around rejecting perhaps some of the help from both British and other allies around the world.
So over the course of the book, you note, you often note the ways that we have to avoid, or we should avoid thinking of suffragette as a single homogenous category. And you do a lot of really effective work to show the multiple factions and groups working towards a shared goal, but with very different interests and from very different positions of power. So can you talk a little bit about the writing of this book, where you highlight the importance of a number of singular women and their activities, but you also talk about broader groups. So can you talk about perhaps the challenges of that and how you navigated that?
Yeah, it was hard. I guess, although, so I think when I think about it now, when I look at it and when I talk about it, although I do discuss lots of individual women, and the suffrage movement was dominated by certain individual women at different stages, and in a real sense, there's only a handful of Indian women who are the ones who are moving around the world or corresponding and engaging with these international or imperial networks, especially because my book doesn't really concentrate on the domestic grassroots campaigns that take place in India. So as much as it's based on those individual women, I'm not really interested in those individual women as biography or as single women. I'm much more interested in the broader questions around locality and space and how suffrage is being understood, and I guess the broader trajectory of those campaigns. So, the book was, as all projects are, a long time in kind of thinking about before writing and researching. And I guess from a fairly early stage, especially because I talked to friends who are historical geographers, I really thought that I wanted to divide and think about this work in terms of those different geographical spaces which we've discussed in the ways which the book has been laid out. And that idea of that those geographical locations were something that was there early on and influenced the way in which I went into the archives and planned all my research and everything else. So, yeah, I guess, it goes back to the very first question. The book is really much more interested in, and the subtitle of the book itself is interested in the female identities, and so identity politics, although that's not necessarily so fashionable today in the current political climate, but I am still interested in identity politics and those transnational networks much more than what did Rajkumari Amrit Kaur do on the 10th of December 1932, or what did Mithun Tata do on the 11th of August 1990. I don't remember those details. And of course, those details are in the book, but to me, they are less important than the broader theoretical things I'm trying to do.
Yeah, and I think that really comes to the fore in the ways that you foreground these spatial interactions and what you term, you know, your contact zones. You could see the ways that, of course, there are individuals who are, as you say, are, you know, considered leaders at a particular moment, but it's really much more about how they're moving through space and networking across groups. So, I mean, that certainly comes to the fore.
Okay, thank you. And I mean, there's an appendix, which I included at the end, because I was aware perhaps that I didn't discuss these individuals very much, or I do, but maybe people wanted to know more about them. So I do have brief biographies of some of the key individuals as an appendix.
So this question is somewhat related in terms of a focus on individual actions, et cetera. But, you know, as many of our listeners know, this year is the centenary of the 1918 Representation of the People Act. So that means that there's been considerable attention to the British context and British developments this year. So in focusing on Indian suffragettes, you're making important revisions to existing focus and histories of global suffrage movements. So, I mean, this is a bit of a big question, but I mean, how do you envision the future of the history of suffrage? Where do you see this going?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, yeah, so for me, and you know, I'm based in the UK and I've been involved in lots of activities around this centenary, which is around, obviously around a British commemoration. I think there's two things. There's what I want, and I think how the field still works. So I really, really, and there are scholars before me who've been doing this, so I'm by no means the first one at all. But I really want us, for scholars who are working on, and again, I wouldn't really describe myself as a suffrage historian. I would describe myself as, a historian more broadly. But what I really want to do, and want historians to do when they're thinking about suffrage is not to just focus on Britain or America as these spaces of suffrage activity. And I still feel, just in general knowledge, in very many parts of the world, that when you just say the word suffrage or suffragette or suffragist, people will automatically think of Britain and America and some of the key figures that have pervaded public consciousness even beyond those two countries. Yeah, I guess my mission here was to show that not only were in this, you know, it's not just that Indian women were involved in suffrage campaigns, but that they were engaging with a very vibrant global movement around suffrage. Nearly every single country in the world has had some form of a suffrage movement. And most of those suffrage movements have been connected to each other or to certain other international or regional or larger organisations. There are very few suffrage movements that have just been localised. So, yeah, I guess I was trying to build upon the work of historians who've been looking at women's movements in this kind of global purview. So I really hope that going forward, historians of suffrage, even if they are just concentrating on their local country, are aware of international connections that those suffrage movements inevitably had with other parts of the world. And yet I still feel that suffrage is again, you know, I say it's a word, it's a term that seems to dominate histories that are written about Britain and America. As I said, you know, I think the book that I'm writing, although suffrage is really important, it's not just about suffrage. And these Indian women were not just, I focus you know, the focus is just on what they did around suffrage. But these are Indian women and other women who are corresponding, involved in networks, involved in organizations and so forth around women's rights more broadly as well. Of course, the suffrage is something, giving women the vote has a knock-on effect, and they understand that will have a knock-on effect on other women's rights. But they're also, while they are meeting in these spaces to discuss suffrage, they are also discussing other issues around education, violence against women and girls, and so many other issues. So I think that for historians who are writing about suffrage, they need to always be conscious of how, yeah, debates around suffrage or women and men who were stylized themselves as suffragettes or suffragists or led suffrage organizations were, had broader lives than just suffrage.
Excellent. So, Samita, we're almost out of time. But before we go, here at New Books Network, we traditionally end our discussions by asking what you're working on next.
Well, I'm not working on anything at the moment. The book is just out, so I'm kind of recovering from the whole process. But just looking forward, my plans are to, I mean, the questions that I've been asking in this book are something that I will continue to ask. I don't think that they'll be around suffrage again. I think that there's issues around mobility, identity, migration and space are things that are going to, I think, continue to interest me as I go forward.
Excellent. Well, we will keep an eye out for the book and for future projects. So thank you again for joining us. And
thank you, Jess, for having me on.
And thank you to all our listeners. Until next time.